Reading from The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser, Chapter the 11th. One of the great things about pirate ships in the good old days was that they were purpose-built, not for cargoes of crude oil or containers or packaged tourists, but for knavery and conspiracy and swashbuckling and, in a word, romance. There had to be a stateroom spacious enough for the likes of Tyrone and George Sanders to fight their climactic duel. Well, try and stage that sort of Barney in some 4x2 cabin on G deck with twin bunks and a corner wash basin and see how far you get. And there had to be smaller cabins with stout oaken doors and heavy brass locks for kidnapped heiresses and hapless señoritas to cower behind while drunken dons or people like Firebeard smashed the panels in. There had to be doorways high enough for stalwart heroes to stride through masterfully without catching their heads a shattering crash just as they were about to say, "So, proud Isabella, we meet again!" Or, "Ha-ha, Gomez, our reckoning is due," as the case may be. Then there had to be fetid compartments deep in the bowels of the vessel for plotting bloody mutiny, do you see? Secret nooks for hiding treasure maps or jewels of price, rat-filled orlops for confining prisoners, pitch-black holds for knife fights with gigantic negroes, and a great network of secret passages for stowaways, assistant heroes, and various eccentrics to lurk in, and for dreadful nameless things to pop out during the middle watch and knife the man at the wheel. Without these basic amenities, a pirate ship simply was not complete, for it was an unwritten law of the period that no one, especially the captain, should be aware exactly who was on board, or where, or why, at any given time. Consequently, when Colonel Blood scrambled unseen aboard the Frantic Frog off Aves, he had no difficulty in lying low. In fact, he had a hell of a job avoiding the other stowaways who were hiding out beneath its decks and behind its bulkheads, a couple of wandering madmen with white beards and ragged trousers who whimpered round the forecastle heads at night, a rather vague scholar surrounded by pet mice and the works of Proust in a forward lazarette, two Huguenot refugees under the floor in the crow's nest, an absconding Italian countess shacked up with her stable boy in the cable tier, and three large families of Pakistanis en route for Bradford. Indeed, it took Blood several days burrowing and stumbling around in the dark before he found an untenanted priest hole near the rudder, once he'd heaved out a couple of skeletons and discovered the secret passage to the galley storeroom, where victuals could be stolen night and morning, except Sundays, early closing. He was beginning to get the hang of things, and by peering through spy holes, listening at scuttles, and prowling warily, he soon learned something of what was afoot in the regular above-decks part of the ship, where the pirates were. It wasn't reassuring. The Frantic Frog appeared to be sailing full speed towards Cartagena on the main, there to rendezvous in secret with Bilbo and Black Sheba, who, Blood gathered, were contemplating some frightful devilry to do with the Spanish viceroy and his bride-to-be. Rackham was assembling other buccaneer vessels at Tortuga, and they were going to devastate Latin America by the sound of it. Not that Blood gave two hoots about that. His one concern was how he was going to slide out to safety, preferably in territory not infested either by pirates or Spaniards. Difficult on the main in those days. Anyway, since they seemed to be entirely surrounded by Atlantic at the moment, there was nothing for our Tom to do but keep his head down and enjoy the bilge water which sloshed around in his hiding place. But, being Blood, of course, he couldn't keep still. He prowled around the secret places of the Frantic Frog from one peephole to another, getting occasional glimpses of forecastle laundry, Frenchmen's knees, the backs of furniture, and some quite interesting bits of plank. But nothing of great moment, until one day, snooping in a hitherto unexplored passage towards the stern, he found two spy holes close together, high in the bulkhead, guessed that they were the cut-out eyes of some portrait hanging in a cabin, and clambered up on a rickety packing case for a deco. Sure enough, he was looking into a richly furnished cabin with ormolu-encrusted chairs, buhl tables, tasselated curtains, impressionist doilies, fin de siècle dartboards, a beribboned guitar with the sheet music of Le Mort est bleu, and all the fixings one would expect in a French marine stateroom of the period, including... The colonel gave a startled gasp, as into his view came a trim foot and ankle, a well-turned calf, and finally a smooth white thigh, whose owner was adjusting a suspender on the top of an elaborately clocked stocking, almost dislocating his neck in an effort to squint. Wicked Tom lost his precarious foothold, and with a despairing cry went head first through the painting and crashed full length on the cabin floor in a cloud of dust and lumps of canvas to the accompaniment of feminine squeaks. "As I suspected, there is death-watch beetle all through the panelling, and it'll cost a mint to put right," he was improvising hastily, and then, "You!" cried Vanity, shrinking back, all corset and fripperies. "Why, thou errant peeper and transom lurker, would spy on my déshabille, wastro? Out, I say, thou rake helly—" "Keep your voice down," hissed Blood. "I'm a stowaway." And having assured himself that they were alone, he quickly brought her up to date, while Vanity got behind the couch, eyeing him mistrustfully. "So, you see, we're after being companions in distress," he concluded with his manliest smile, which sent Vanity skipping back even farther. "But what of the mad Frog Pugh? Last I saw, he was raving about you being the light of his life on account of your turning brunette. Has he—" "Ah," he coughed delicately, eyeing her peekaboo undress. "That is, have you and he, you know—" "Certainly not," snapped Vanity indignantly. "Know that he hath used me with all respect. Nay, it ran close on reverence, the which," she admitted, frowning, "I am at a loss to understand, for while I know well that I have the message for the chaps, yet are they wont to get physical rather than spiritual, and Captain Pugh's passion has thus far been that of a worshipper towards a deity. Mind you, it takes all sorts. There was a gardener at our school who used to steal my gym shoes—"
"You mean he hasn't touched you?"
Blood was incredulous.
"But look at the way you're dressed."
"Stop looking," cried Vanity. "Thou muckrake, these are but the garments he provided for me before he had his nervous breakdown. It's true, I tell you," she added, moving a chair between them. "The day after we sailed from Aves, he vowed undying devotion at my feet, calling me Little Apple and Little Pear, and swearing to wed me as soon as he had mastered the irregular verbs at the end of Book Two."
"Thou kidst! Is he clean corkor, then?"
"You better believe it, for of a sudden he clutched his brow, pale-faced and staggered, crying, 'Croire, joindre, offrir, pouvoir!' and fell down in a fit. His crew put him to bed, where he lies and babbles of the imperfect indicative of connaître, and crying sore for his beauteous beloved with a big mouth, whatever that may mean."
"Wait!" Blood snapped his fingers. "It's coming back to me. Did you do French at school? Well, then, do you not recall the lesson about the wench whose mouth was too big, and the doctor bade her say, petite pomme,' over and over, so should her trap diminish? But she, being flighty piece and misremembering what fruit he had specified, repeated 'petite poire,' so that her gob got bigger than ever. I mind me there was a picture of her in our school-book, a well-curved and oomphish brunette, and 'tis my guess this lunatic Pew did fall in love wi' it, and seeth thee, with thy hair stained with galoopa juice, supposed thou art she. See? So keep up the dye job, and you're safe enough for—
Safe! Shrilled Vanity. Safe in the clutches of a buccaneering hophead who devours me with wild eyes and drools of honeymoons in Bermuda. Anyway, my mouth is not too big. Sure, it is small and dainty rosebud.
And she turned to regard it indignantly in the mirror.
He probably wasn't looking at your mouth, observed Blood dryly, edging closer. No wonder, the way you traipse around in shorty night rails, gauzy pants, floral bikinis, and frilly corsets. I can't think when I last saw ye with your clothes on, thank God, he added, taking a playful pat.
But Vanity hadn't played mixed lacrosse for nothing, and as the colonel hopped and swore with a hacked shin and a finger-jabbed eye, she grabbed up a heavy brass candlestick and stood on guard.
"What was that for?" cried Blood. "A mere brotherly gesture of affection to comfort thee."
"Try it again," threatened Vanity, "and I scream for help. Then shall we see how happy Dan's Pew do serve the molester other captains intended."
"You've got me all wrong," protested Blood,
and hastily revised his strategy, the crafty knave.
"I mean only thy service, for consider that once Happy Dan hath recovered from his irregular verbs, thou'rt right in it, gorgeous child. Ay, unless you want to end up as Mistress Pew, laygirl or not, you must rely on honest Tom Blood to pluck you from this pickle, and he's the boy to do it, so he is."
"Ha! In a pig's ear, I'll warrant."
"In a nutshell, rather. Dear Vanity, this cursed ship is bound for Cartagena on the main, there to join with Black Sheba, Bilbo, and to other of the damned coast brethren in fell design against the Spanish viceroy. If you want to find yourself playing dig with that lot, I don't," said the colonel earnestly. "And since we're only a few days' sail from Cartagena, I suggest you let me devise our evasion forthwith."
He drummed up his most winning, crinkly smile.
"Come, lady, is it a truce?"
Vanity weighed the candlestick suspiciously.
"Shalt keep thy paws to thyself, no playing footsie even?"
"Perish the thought," promised Blood, crossing his fingers unseen. "Not until we're safely out of this lot," he reflected lecherously, "the rotter."
"Pax, skinch, and keys, honest Injun?"
"On me old mother's grave. You'll be as safe with me as with your precious Ben Avery, wherever the hell he's got to."
At this mention of her lost love, Vanity was so moved that the candlestick fell from her nerveless fingers. Her eyes misted, and a great shuddering sigh convulsed her bosom. Blood gave a sharp moan and bit his lip.
"Please don't do that," he pleaded. "Not in that corset."
Touched by his restraint, and not a little flattered, the minx, Vanity composed herself and recounted how she had been awaiting Avery on the Isle of Aves when Happy Dan abducted her. "Though how he knew of my whereabouts is more than I can guess," said she, frowning, while Rascal Tom shook his head innocently.
"Nor why my darling Ben was late in coming for me. I fear he may have met with some mischance."
"Mischance," murmured Blood absently, "or Miss Barbados."
Vanity stiffened.
"What was that crack?"
"What? Oh, nothing,"
Blood started elaborately.
"It's just slipped out. Think it aloud. Forget it."
Vanity went pink, white, and several more becoming intermediate shades.
"Creep," cried she, "do you imply that my dream boat is gallivanting after yon beldame Sheba? 'Tis foul lie, told out of jealous spite by treacherous Marplot, thou. Ah! I mind how you tried to sow dissension twixt us in the boat, just because his perfection makes you look like something left out for the bin men. You seek to sully him in mine eyes. Typical!"
Her perfect lips whiffled, and her corset creaked with contempt. "And about what I'd expect from a cad who tried to cop the crown jewels, betrayed my love's mission, snuck off with a piece of the Madagascar crown, and e'en now invaded my toilet and made passes. Why, what a caitiff stinkard art thou, and where—" she demanded, as Blood, the sly skunk, turned away meekly and started to climb through the shattered picture towards the secret passage. "Do you think you're going?"
"Back into the woodwork," said Blood humbly, "since I am not wanted, and have by thoughtless inadvertence given offence to your ladyship. I'll e'en hie me back among my friends the rats and cockroaches. I beg your ladyship's pardon," he sighed heavily. "Fare ye well," said he in a quivery voice, and as he began to clamber through the wrecked painting, the artful villain sneaked a scrap of paper from his pocket and let it flutter to the floor.
"Take your litter with you," said Vanity coldly, and picked up the paper to thrust it at him with disdain, when she noted the dread signature, Sheba the She-Wolf, and the row of kisses writ as crosses. Her beauteous orbs bugged, and in an instant she had conned the note and yowled with rage and dismay.
"I pad my bra?" she shrilled. "What infamy is this? Who, to whom, what, yikes, whence had ye this vile libel?"
Now you'll have guessed that this paper was the letter which Sheba had written to Avery, and which the colonel had purloined unnoticed on Dead Man's Chest. See page 120. Ripe stuff in which the pirate queen had poured out her passion. Blood, halfway through the wall, feigned vexation and made a feeble snatch at the letter. A pretty piece of acting, marred by his accidentally rending his breeches painfully on a splinter. Vanity goggled distraught at the letter.
"Did that saucy sable slut write this to Captain Avery?" she gnashed.
"No, she wrote it to Louis the 14th," snarled Blood, his composure disturbed by splinters in his rear. "Of course she wrote it to Avery. Oh, what have I said?"
He smote his forehead in pretended remorse.
"Och, hon, I would have spared ye this, but aye, she wrote it to him. Why not? She's a woman, and he's God's gift. Do you wonder she dotes on him? Didn't he save her from a flogging and show her tender regard?"
"So did you," cried Vanity wildly, white to the gills.
"But I'm a caitiff stinkard," said Blood, all martyred. "Everyone knows that. Not like Wonder Boy." He gave a wounded shrug. "Mind you, I didn't go drooling after her, first chance I got, having lulled and abandoned my trusting betrothed on a desert island to be scooped up by Happy Dan Pugh. Nay, I didn't vow eternal love to the purest, sweetest saint that ever curved a corset, while engaging in secret correspondence with a virago who says that you pad your bra. A malicious and laughable lie, incidentally, from where I'm standing."
He shook his head with a brave, sad smile. "Such are not the ways of Colonel Blood." Vanity stared from him to the letter in stunned dismay, like the class idiot called on to solve a quadratic equation.
"My senses swim," she faltered. "Oh, can he be false indeed? What am I to believe?"
She sank limply to the couch, and a great tear sploshed on the crumpled letter.
"See, this abandoned cow writes to my personal fiancé as beloved, and barracuda baby, and I know not what. Would she do this if he had spurned her, as he pretended? Oh, if he's two-timing me, the rat! Nay, but 'tis not on. He is an English gentleman, and she an alien tramp whose very colour must repel."
"Some people go for black jelly beans," observed Blood cryptically.
And as Vanity clutched her temples, the oily rogue climbed swiftly down into the cabin again and took up a strategic kneeling position by the couch.
"Ah, sweet Vanity, to see thee thus ill-used," he murmured,
and although the amount of silk and leg on view cried out for a juicy pinch, he schooled himself to imprint a chaste kiss on her little toe. No fires broke out, so he essayed a reverent smooch on her instep.
"'Don't do that,' moaned Vanity, distracted. "'It reminds me of Happy Dan Pugh.' She clasped her brow and seemed to become aware of him all of a sudden. "'What are you doing, for God's sake?'
"'Worshipping,' said Blood, pathetically.
"'Eh?' Her wits were quite disordered. Ah, of your pity, one emotional crisis at a time. Here am I, distraught, lest my lover has handed me the welly, and you nibble at my nylons.
She shook a bemused, galooped head.
Hold on. When you spoke a moment since of the purest saint who ever curved a corset, did you mean me? You?
Who else? Blood looked at her like a distempered poodle.
And... that your regard for me is honourable, that you're not mere groper and nuisance?
Blood nodded dumbly, and Vanity stared, amazed.
Oh, pull the other one.
Or rather, don't. And she hastily swung her legs aside, while the wily ruffian shook his handsome, curly head.
Oh, Vanity, acushla, quoth he. Get a grip, take a deep breath, and consider the facts. 'Tis true, I betrayed the Madagascar crown to the pirates, well knowing that if I did not, thy precious self would have been next on their shark's menu. Thereafter, compare my conduct with a certain others, who rushed to thy side in Akbar's cabin and gave thee a fireman's lift, cruelly though you requited him, and who neglected thee in his eagerness to slaughter the wog and grab the jewelry, who washed the dishes in the boat, humbly preparing bully and tinned pears for thy delight, and who lulled the stern and beguiled thee with fair words, who, rather than stay on Aves, where he might have lapped up the goodies in safety, followed thee here aboard, and now kneels at your feet, offering his life in your service, and who couldn't wait to get after Black Sheba, and may e'en now, for aught we know, be working the zipper on her tracksuit? I name no names, crooned the insidious scoundrel. But leave it to your woman's intuition to judge what the hell I'm talking about. I can't cope, whimpered Vanity. I'm in a state. Ah, what is a poor friendless maid to think? Gosh, I'll break that blighter's neck if, as I suspicion, he has the hots for yon dark Delilah. And you, making like Galahad, and yet... ye deserted from the boat, swiped Akbar's cross, and left a note in which ye maligned me grossly, and spoke of living it up in the stews of Libertatia.
A mere device to cover up the suicide on which I was intent, distracted as I was at seeing you in the arms of that smoothie Avery, protested Blood glibly.
If 'twas known I'd done away with myself, how could me old mother have collected the insurance, and her living on mouldy spuds in a turf pigsty in Galway. But a chance current bore me ashore, God be thanked, since I'm spared to serve you in your sore need, and prove the depth of my... Ah, dare I say it? Oh, go on, why not? Unworthy though I am, and timid and hesitant and misunderstood, I, the depth of my true love for thee, dear delectable Vanity.
Strong material. And if she half swallowed it, well, defenseless females in need of rescuing from pirates seldom remain indifferent to Clark Gable respectfully stroking their toes and giving them the dimple. And if you wonder why the bounder was pitching such ardent woo, it was because he was looking ahead to the point where he had borne her safely back to civilization. He was Irish and optimistic, remember, and had earned her gratitude and possibly some warmer emotion, the scheming snake. His raffish charm might well catch her on the rebound from Avery, whom he had so cunningly discredited, and there were worse billets than being old Rook's son-in-law with Vanity's charms as an added bonus. So the rascal reasoned, while Vanity heaved another bewildered sigh and absently smoothed her stockings, actions which forced Blood to keep a tight hold on himself, raised her lovely tear-stained face, screwed up Sheba's note with a final jealous gnash, and regarded the kneeling colonel with a gym-mistress tilt to her queenly chin.
"Right," she said, "little choice have I. The galupa juice is growing out. I'll be blonde again before you know it, and heaven knows how that screwball Pew will react when he realizes I'm not Miss Big Mouth after all. Whether Captain Avery be false or no, 'tis to thee I must look for present aid. Easy, boy, easy," she cried, as Blood pressed ardent lips to her extended hand. "Swallowing my arm is not part of the deal. As Lady Equality and ranking society pippin, I am far above thy touch, so don't get fresh, understand? But extract me from this garboil, and shalt have such reward." Here she shot him that cool, hands-off but wait-and-see look which had ravished the Whitehall beaux, as I may deem fitting. "Cripes, what's that?" For from an adjoining cabin came strange sounds, a voice that babbled, "Connaître, connaissant, connu, present indicative, and, amour de ma vie, connaissez," followed by an exultant scream of laughter, "I have found it! Eureka! The imperfect indicative, n'est-ce pas?" And as Blood and Vanity stood rooted, came running feet and roars of, "The captain recovers his marbles. He is cured. Bring aft the rum, Darby, and listen to this." "We are undone," gasped Vanity. "Pew has mastered his irregular verbs."
"Are you sure?" Blood was tense. "He hasn't got to the present subjunctive yet."
"It skills not," cried Vanity, clasping her corset and stamping her foot impatiently. "He'll be here any moment to claim me as his bride. We must flee. Quickly, plan our escape while I get a dress on."
She shot behind a screen, and Blood rushed to the stern windows. There, not a mile distant, was a green, jungly coastline. The main, probably, peopled by terrors indescribable. But what the hell? If it wasn't Blackpool Beach, it was still their only hope. Outside, the tumult grew.
"Connaissez, imperfect indicative,"
Happy Dan was chortling, amidst rapturous applause from his followers.
"Et aussi connaîtrez the future. How's about that, eh?"
His crew stamped and shouted, while Blood considered and rejected various means of escape as feverishly as Vanity, behind her screen, was running through a selection of garments. Thus, by the time the colonel had decided against swimming, too far, floating ashore in barrels, too slow, and building a raft, sure to attract attention, the fair captive had discarded mauve taffeta, flowered silk, see-through scarlet nylon, not safe, she felt, in view of Blood's propensities, and cloth of gold, and had emerged in a most becoming maroon velvet number with her hair up. Blood was peering out of the stern window and swearing foully.
"There's no boat," he cried. "Jesus, trust the French! Whoever heard a pirate ship without a small boat moored near the stern and provisioned with all necessities so that fugitives can light out unseen?"
"But they're coming," cried Vanity. "Listen!"
Sure enough, from without the cabin, a great cheer had gone up.
"Vive l'imperfect indicative! Dix out of dix for le capitaine! And it's his turn to clean the tableau noir!"
And then the voice of Happy Dan Pew, sounding distressingly sane,
"Merci, mes enfants. And now to claim my bride, la jeune fille avec la grande bouche."
Blood didn't hesitate. With one hand he snatched a convenient rapier from the wall, and with the other he swept Vanity almost bodily through the gaping hole in the picture and into the passage behind. An instant later, and they were crouched in the dark of the secret passage, while the cabin door burst in, and Happy Dan's glad cry of
"Ouvrez la porte, ma belle!"
ended in a shriek of dismay.
"Où est elle? Elle n'est pas ici! Ah! But I am staggered, me. I feel not well. I should have stayed on the deck avec papa."
"With any luck, he'll have a relapse," whispered Blood, "and we can lurk unseen and get our breath back."
"But will they not see the great rent in the canvas picture?"
hissed Vanity, huddled against him.
"Hang it, it's about 3 feet across."
"Not a chance," hissed Blood. "What with his shock of your disappearance, he's probably back to lesson one by now. I doubt if he could tell ye what je suis means. They'll have eyes for naught else."
Pat on his words, came a yell from the cabin. Mais regardez, mon capitaine, un grand trou dans l'image sur la mur. C'est the way elle has gone.
Oh, that's a nuisance, said Blood, and his hairy heads thrust through the hole to stare into the gloom of the passage, he got to his feet, carefully pushed Vanity behind him, and fell on guard. Scoundrel he might be, but when the chips were down and there was nowhere left to run, our Tom knew what to do.
I'm sorry, Acushla. Fine help I been to ye, after all. I'll hold 'em as best I can, and when they've finished me, ye can tell 'em I was kidnapping you. Play along with Pew, and take your chances when it comes.
Vanity's gasp was lost in the yells of the French pirates as they spotted the fugitive pair crouched in the gloom of the passage. They swarmed through into that narrow place, a wild-eyed Pew at their head, flourishing his épée in one hand and a lace hanky in the other.
"Ah, scélérat, Irish chien," he cried. "Vous êtes un voleur de la forêt, pas de doute. What do I see but that you ravish away my love, méchant? Now we pay you back for Lansdowne Road. En garde. Don't worry, petite pomme. Happy Dan is here to rescue vous."
The blades clanged, and as Blood faced his crazed adversary and the horde of ruffians pressing behind him, he was conscious of Vanity's hand on his shoulder. Just a moment it pressed there before it fell away, and Blood felt a strange content and lightness of heart as he parried Happy Dan's thrust and sent his point through the shoulder of a bearded lout at the French captain's elbow. Then he was retreating, parrying and riposting for all he was worth as they surged down on him three abreast into a wider space where a convenient lantern flickered. Vanity shuddered back against the bulkhead, and Happy Dan, turning a low lunge from Blood, leaped to her side, flourishing his blade and crying, "See, I come, moi, Happy Dan! Give him the business, garçon!"
"Ah, nay," cried Vanity, in the frog's fevered grasp, "spare him!"
"Not a chance," roared the French pirates,
closing on Blood, brandishing their cutlasses.
"Regardez, Paddy, here it comes!" "Ach, the hell with ye!" cried Blood. "College morning forever!"
And he hurled his back to the bulkhead, thrusting deep into the chest of an assailant, preparing to take their steel in his turn and die, he reflected, in unexpectedly gallant fashion, defending beauty from the powers of darkness. Then the timbers at his back seemed to give way, rotten boards crumbled about him, and he stumbled back and fell on a cold, half-yielding surface that clanked and slithered most strangely beneath him. His rapier, jarred from his hand, tinkled away, and with yells of amazement his attackers stopped dead, staring in disbelief at what they saw. Happy Dan, with Vanity half-swooning in his grasp, thrust through them and halted gaping at the sight which confronted him in the flickering lamplight. Crashing through the rotten bulkhead, Colonel Blood had fallen back into a secret cell deep in the bowels of the frantic frog. He was floundering helplessly on its contents, a great, shimmering, shifting heap of gold coin, in which, as he staggered to his feet, he was buried above the knees. "Hidden treasure, by the powers! And about time, too, says you, and right ye are. And if its discovery has come about without the usual aids of faded maps in spidery writing, and skeleton signposts pointing to ye treasure pit, don't worry, its disposal will be bizarre enough to satisfy the most traditional taste. Let's leave Blood wallowing in it, while Vanity presses fearful knuckles to apprehensive teeth, and Happy Dan's crew go into hysterics, and haste us back to Cartagena, where things ought to be hotting up nicely."